Welcome back, all of you, after a long period of absence. So, as we normally do when we resume the classes after some interval, I try to explain the invocation verses, and then we'll go to the text. So, the invocation is Yogena chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya cha vaitikena yopakrutam pravaram muninam padanjalim pranchaliranatosmi stuve padanjalim vyasam shankaram cha munitrayam kartrasutrasya bhashyasya kramar vivaranasya cha. So this two Sanskrit verses remind us of the antiquity of the yoga tradition and its profound spiritual, philosophical background. So the author of this text is Patanjali. Patanjali is a great philosopher, a great saint, and a great psychologist who may have lived around 14th century BC. So the sutras, Yoga Sutras, as you mean, that's the name of the text, were originally written by this great saint called Patanjali. Now, what is a sutra? A sutra is, in English, as most of you may know, is called an aphorism. Now, an aphorism is a statement, a short statement, which may not be a complete sentence. It could be in the form of a phrase, one or two words, sometimes one or two letters, as frequently it happens in the aphorisms of Sanskrit grammatical literature. It belongs to 9th century BC, it's a Panini's sutras, Ashtadhyayi sutras they call. Now, the author is Patanjali. So, this system, the yoga tradition, has got the background of three great saintly authors at the background of the evolution of the yoga system. The first one is Patanjali, the one who wrote these aphorisms, 195 small pithy statements which constitute the entire yoga sutra text divided into four chapters dealing with the means, the methods of practices, the effects of those practices, then the dynamics of yogic concentration and the concept of liberation from the cycles of life and death and rebirths that constitute the theme of the text. Now, a great student of Patanjali, he was not directly his student, but who was perhaps, who lived around 500 years after Patanjali. His name is Vyasa, who wrote a commentary on the Patanjali Yoga Sutras. Without his commentary, we won't be able to make out anything of the profound psychological teachings of this text. Without Vyasa's commentary. He was the one who brought to light the substance of Yoga Sutra literature. By the way, when I use the word yoga, all of you have got a picture of somebody standing on his head or her head or assuming different physical postures. That's certainly very good for mind and body and intellect. That's true for health especially. But that only constitutes just one aspect and not a very important aspect of the entire yoga system. Yoga goes far beyond that. The analysis of yoga sutras, the analysis of the human mind, the analysis of the dynamics, the problems of what we now call in psychiatry, the problems of anxiety, depression, schizophrenic problems, delusions, phobias, obsessions, conflicts, illusions, all these are very, very elaborately and graphically expounded and described by Vyasa and other commentators who came after him, who continued writing on Yoga Sutra literature, who enriched the entire Yoga Sutra literature. Another great, and maybe far greater person came around 1,000 years after Vyasa. His name is Shankaracharya, who is supposed to be one of the greatest spiritual teachers the world has ever seen. Incidentally, he is known as the greatest philosopher saint of India. He is the one who actually philosophically expounded what we now call Vedanta system, Vedanta philosophy. So he wrote a commentary on the same sutra literature based on Vyasa's commentary. He also brings out many, many teachings, many, many subtle aspects of Yoga Sutra and Yoga Psychology and Yoga Philosophy. And apart from these three, there have been many other great commentators, philosophers and writers. Incidentally, many of them were Buddhists. Buddhist philosophers and psychologists made a tremendous contribution, mostly those who belong to the Mahayana system, made a great contribution to yoga system, and to the extent that one of their schools is known as Yogacara system because they were great practitioners of yoga. So Yogacara is one of Vijnanavada, another name, is one of the most important philosophical systems of Buddhist tradition. Incidentally, this mindfulness, vipassana, meditation, they all sprang from the Yogacara system, which incidentally is indebted to the Yoga Sutra psychology. So this is a background. So these two verses in a way pay tribute to the great trio, the great three philosophers and saints who developed yoga to the present stature. Okay, now we are going to deal with the fourth chapter. We have completed all the three chapters of the Yoga Sutra. Discussion will be going on for more than 3 years. And you can find in our YouTube, you find videos, you may also find in our website resources, audio, video, you find all these discussions. More than 100 classes already be over. Now we are going to deal with the fourth chapter. It's called the chapter on liberation. It's called Kaivalyam. Kaivalyam means liberation. Liberation from what? And why should we go for liberation? All these are to be explained at the very beginning. Now, we should know that yoga aims to liberate you from yourself. It helps us to liberate from ourselves. So there are two entities within us. One, the physical, psychological, mental personality, which goes on changing, our body changes, obviously. Mind also changes, and when we do some action with the mind and body, any of the senses of perception or senses of action, whatever we do will produce a side effect, a byproduct, a residual effect. It is called in yoga tradition called vritti. Well, we can see that you cannot even think a wrong thought, an undesirable thought, without simultaneously creating a problem for yourself. And you cannot even think a noble thought without simultaneously doing some good to you. We can never do anything wrong to others without simultaneously doing something wrong to ourselves. And we cannot even have a thought, a flash of ideas in the mind which will not produce some continuing effect or impact, and that remains in our mental system. That is actually the foundation of habit formations. So yoga, in a way, explains this, this unique process. Why do we do certain things in a certain manner? Though we won't like to do it that way, there are many people in this world who every day will try to bring about a change in their life, mental life, physical life, whatever life. There are many things that people want to do. There are many deeds that we are interested in, many thoughts we would like to think. Well, you can try to program your own mind. Well, you can program a machine, a computer, but you can never program our own mind. Our mind doesn't follow our dictates. The machine, the machine that we manufacture, that we produce, follow our dictates. But our own mind doesn't often listen to us. If our mind always listened to us, there will be absolutely no problem in the world. They say in criminology, about 90% of the hardcore criminals would like to bring about a change in their life. I'm talking about the normal situation, maybe till about 1970s, 1980s, before the concept of committed hardcore criminal it emerged. That has changed the whole dynamics of the science. So there is no one in the world who deliberately want to do something which he knows very well will eventually be doing harm to himself. But we can't help doing it. So what does it mean? In all of us, there are two entities. One, what we want to do, something that we want to be, some words we want to speak, some thoughts we want to think. And that is on the one hand. And then the words that we actually speak, the deeds that we actually do, we may be totally different. The thoughts we actually think could be totally different from what we would like to think, would like to speak, and would like to do. So by this conflict, this mystery is being solved for the first time in the history of psychology by the great commentator Vyasa, who wrote his commentary on the Yoga Sutras. So Vyasa is the originator of the concept of what we now use, the word samskara. Now this is used just like karma, the samskara also has become a word commonly used in any book dealing with yoga system or mainstream psychology. Those who have some understanding of Eastern psychological traditions will use this word samskara, is A-M-S-K-A-R-A. They use it for want of a better term, something for want of an equivalent in English language. So it is Vyasa who first put forward this idea. We do certain things in a certain manner because of samskaras. And we don't have any control over samskaras. In short, kaivalya is nothing but or liberation. Kaivalya pada means the fourth part of Yoga Sutra literature, the fourth chapter. Kaivalya means freedom, liberation. Spiritual freedom, spiritual liberation. So spiritual liberation here means freedom from the shackles of our own samskaras, vasanas and vritti. So these are all interrelated terms. So whatever we do, any action, any thought, any word that we speak, all will leave behind something in our own mental system, not in others. If it is a good action, it will produce a positive, healthy vritti. The vritti is a name used in the yoga literature. If you read the translations, the word used is wave. But the word wave, as it is understood in English dictionary, in the dictionaries, will not explain the true implication of what vritti implies in yoga psychology. Vritti is a wave that is created in our mental system. So to think of the mind as a lake, and you throw a stone, and the stone has maybe it has gone deep, but the water, there is a disturbance, a ripple on the water surface. But there is a difference. In the lake, it doesn't remain for long, but in the mental system, it remains there. So number of such vrittis, residual effects of all our actions or experiences or anything involving the senses of perception, senses of action or mind, will create a vritti, and a number of identical vrittis will produce a strong tendency which actually build a character. It's called samskara. So samskara is something that we cannot get out of unless we try to reverse the process. I mean, we have to, why it's called in the yoga system, the idea of liberation is a kind of reverse evolution, and for that you have to understand the Sankhya philosophical system. It will take some time, but I shall try to explain. So these samskaras will remain our mental system. Samskaras will become a strong tendency to act in a manner, and that is called vasana. Vasana expresses itself in identical circumstances. So when our mind responds to external conditions, when the external atmosphere conditions are favorable for some good action, good thoughts, good deeds, meditation, then our mind will respond to that. But mind will not respond unless there is something in our own mental system which helps us to connect with that. Suppose we go to a holy place, or we go to a place where it's a place where naturally people come and pray and meditate, or any church or a temple or in place of worship, whatever it may be. Or even a place where you discuss constantly some good thoughts, good ideas, that also becomes a temple, because those vibrations will remain there, strongly enriching the atmosphere. When you go there, then if you feel a tendency to observe that prevailing vibrations, that means our mind is connecting with that external environment. So vasanas will come to the forefront. So vasanas will help us to connect with the existing prevailing conditions. And vasanas will lead to action. Action produces vritti, vasana, samskara. And again, so this is called a kind of vicious circle or cycle. You cannot get out of it. So we are the slaves of what we did yesterday, what we thought yesterday, what we spoke yesterday. We are the slaves of the tendencies and impressions, subtle impressions created by our own actions. Suppose we can evolve a mechanism to get rid of these unnecessary, undesirable tendencies, which we call negativity in psychology. We call negativity. Negativity cannot be resolved by taking a pill. If you take a medicine, you may forget about it, only it will come back with a vengeance after some time, when the effect of the medicine is over. So, either positive or negative ideas, characteristics, all can be reversed if you try to purify your mind. So, in other words, samskaras constitute the essence of a personality, the essence of the way our mind responds to conditions within and without. So this is the theme of the fourth chapter. How to reverse the process? So I used the word reverse evolution earlier. I shall try to explain. This is an idea taken from Sankhya philosophy, which is one of the It is linked to yoga philosophy. We need not pay too much attention to the metaphysical aspects of the system, but its analysis of the human mind is very, very very much accepted by many mainstream philosophers and psychologists, and those who are interested in comparative philosophy find Thales, for example, the 7th century Greek philosopher, was known to be fully familiar with the Sankhya system of evolution. That's a view of a most unlikely man who will admit that. That is Bertrand Russell himself, who wrote History of Western Philosophy. Certainly not the type of person who would admit that the great Thales of 7th century Greece learned something from ancient Indian philosophers. You know. Anyway, so I'm coming to the subject now. So according to the Sankhya system, there are two fundamental realities, eternal realities. One is Purusha, the other is Prakriti. The whole creation, the whole cosmos, the whole universe, including our mind, our intellect, our senses of perception, senses of action, attitudes, the whole phenomenal world, empirical world, valleys, mountains, oceans, rivers, our mind, our intellect, our senses of action, senses of perception like eyes and ears, all these are evolutes of Prakriti according to this philosopher. Please remember, Sankhya's, I'm not going to the details of Sankhya philosophy. Those who are interested can ask me questions. I'll be very happy to respond to those questions in depth. So anyway, in short, so according to Kapila, who is the exponent of Sankhya philosophy, everything is an evolute of Prakriti. So Prakriti means the original material cause from which everything comes. Surprisingly, and to the disappointment of many people, he doesn't talk about a God, a creator God. That's something very interesting. So that's why this Sankhya philosophy attracted the attention of many great scientists and thinkers in the later half of 19th century, because by the end of the 19th century, most of the intellectual elites of Europe came to know of the Sankhya philosophy, which became very popular. In fact, Swami Vivekananda, who came to the United States in 1893 to attend the Parliament of Religion, had long discussions with many great American thinkers on this system of philosophy. Not only thinkers, even a great man like William James, who was a great psychologist, made a great contribution to modern psychology. So Swami Vivekananda had elaborate discussions on this subject. So according to them, the whole creation is, it consists of 24 evolutes of Prakriti. What are the 24 evolutes? It's called in Sanskrit, those who were interested, Chaturvimshati Tattva, means 24 principles which constitute the created universe. Prakriti is one, then Mahatattva, the cosmic energy, from that's also the cosmic intelligence, from that ego system, which has got three main streams, Sattvika, Rajasika and Tamasika, and from this Ahankara, the ego system emerged or evolved the five senses of perception, five senses of action, five subtle elements and five gross elements which constitute the world and mind. So this is in short. That means we have forgotten our true nature. We every minute, every day, we identify ourselves with all the gross things of the world. Now if you try to organize these 24 principles in the form of a pyramid, on the top you have got Prakriti, which is the cause, the origin of this evolutionary process. At the lowest level, you have got the phenomenal empirical world that we contact with every day. So the food to which we are attracted too much, a vision or a sight or a touch or a smell which we get attracted towards, our mind gets attracted. When this happens, we identify ourselves with this phenomenal, empirical, sensory, sensual objects. So, from the Prakriti, we have come down to the lowest level of empirical material universe. So, Every time when we feel disturbed, when we lose money, we look upon ourselves as a physical being who needs money for enjoying this world. So all these ideas are interrelated. So when we get bored intellectually, we identify ourselves with the mind or intellect. So that means we identify ourselves as the enjoyers of the sensory world with the mind, body or intellect or psychophysical system. Now, liberation means you have to get rid of this attraction towards external empirical sensual objects. We have to identify ourselves with what we actually are. And our true nature is that we are something, essentially we are something that goes beyond all these evolutionary processes. We are Purusha, which is the essence of consciousness, awareness, effulgence. We are not part of the matter. Should we identify ourselves with the matter, which changes every minute, which gets destroyed every minute and recreated again, goes on changing? Or should we identify ourselves, should we define ourselves as this material created world? Are we different? Or are we different from a piece of stone, from a mountain, from a valley, from an animal? We are something far beyond all this. That's our true nature. We are Purusha. But due to some ignorance, inherited ignorance, somehow we identify ourselves with these material empirical objects. So to get out of this, we have to reverse the evolutionary process. We have to, first of all, we have to get rid of our attraction towards external objects. From the lowest, grossest level, we have to go to the higher level, the mental, the intellectual, then the spiritual level, when we identify ourselves with one divine reality, consciousness, awareness, that is immanent in all of us, that is also all-pervading, omnipresent, then we get liberated from the shackles of these karmas. Every problem is due to our misidentification, wrong identification with the empirical material objects. A freedom from this wrong identification is implied by the word kaivalya, liberation, in the fourth chapter. Okay, this is the philosophical background. Now I shall come to the subject. So how do we get out of these shackles of our own samskaras, of our own inherited, our own undesirable baggage that we all inherit the day, the moment we are born? That's the next subject. As I mentioned, all samskaras, all impressions are the result of some experiences that we go through, and those experiences leave a burden, a heavy burden in our mental system, and they manifest again as great attractions or great kinds of aversions. We like certain things, we cannot get out of that extreme attachment. We dislike certain things, we cannot get out of extreme aversion. It's called raga and dvesha in Patanjali system and also in Vedanta. Raga means this everyone experiences in this world. There are many things in this world that are good and we are drawn towards them. There are many things that we know to be harmful to us. But we cannot liberate ourselves from an extreme obsessive attachment towards those things. It is called raga. And dvesha means there are many people who have irrational, totally unjustified kinds of aversion, hatred, negativity towards certain things, persons and individuals. They know perhaps very well that it is totally unrealistic, irrational. But that conviction, that understanding of its total ridiculousness will not prevent you from keeping in your mind this burden, this baggage of aversion. So extreme attachment and extreme aversion, these are two main categories that mental world can be divided. In fact, these are two ways in which we react to our own experiences. Experiences from outer world and experiences within our own mind. So, all that I stated right till now, the evolution of Prakriti and the 24 principles, in short, these are all philosophical ideas. But there are people who may not agree with these things, who may not have time to study serious books on metaphysics, but this is something that we cannot deny, because we all live a mental world. And Patanjali knows that very well. So he tells you, well, liberation means to get out of these shackles, these prison walls that we have created within our own mental system. That's why it's liberation from ourselves. So that's why in the yoga tradition, mental world is analyzed under three categories. One, experiences that we go through. Experiences from our own mind, from within ourselves. Hunger, thirst, hatred, aversion, unnecessary irrational attachment or aversion, all this. And again, they may have some connection, some link to external factors. So, how we react to experiences originating from outside of us. So, our reaction, our response to these experiences is called raga and dvesha. In Sanskrit, the experience is called bhoga. Aversion is called dvesha, and extreme irrational attachment is called raga. So, you have to remember, those who are interested, because many, when you read books, advanced books on the subject, they use this word. Bhoga means experiences, raga means extreme attachment, dvesha means extreme aversion. Now, this is the essence of human mind, human character. All the principles of modern psychology, one way or other, are linked to this. Now, here there are two types of experiences according to Patanjali. One is, there are some very strong tendencies which we may not be aware of, which may manifest at times. Only when those tendencies prompt some impulsive actions, reactions, then we dictate the origin of that those impulsive actions. They are samskara. They are very deep samskaras, deep-rooted samskaras. Here, Patanjali will take you beyond this life. He says, there are many characteristics and tendencies and impressions and samskaras which cannot be explained in the light of our experiences in this life. There are people, they're good and bad, both you find. People with extreme, strong inherent interest in certain subjects like music or mysticism or drawing or painting. A child showing extreme interest in painting or music, born in a family with five brothers, five children, none of them interested in music. There were never a musician in their family any time, but you find these tendencies. So, these tendencies point out the possibility of samskaras and impressions coming from not this life, from previous life. And this could happen in the negative way. This is a positive example of positive tendency. Negative tendencies also will come, can be found. So Patanjali says there is a set of samskaras which are stored up in the mental system, which we are not aware of all the time. We aware of the possibility only when these tendencies prompt some impulsive, strong reactions. So, it is called that particular system where these karma, strong karma samskaras are stored up is called karmashaya. So this is an interesting analysis by Patanjali. Now, coming to the subject again, the basic samskaras, when they become strong, when they become deep-rooted, when they manifest in the form of tendencies and impressions, especially attitudes and tendencies of the mind, they are called kleshas. It's called klesha samskaras, it's called Patanjali system. So you can find this happening to many people. I mentioned earlier, according to the yoga psychologist, the most visible, the most illustrative example is a kind of conflict between what we want to do and what our mind permits us, allows us to do. Not always the same. I mentioned earlier, there are many wonderful things we want to do, but something, some invisible mental block won't permit us to do that. We want to speak in a particular manner, but when we speak, we are not able to speak the way we want to speak. Now remember, words and passages or just verbal formations may be possible, but not always. Very often, we won't be able to do what we want to do. So, this is because of inherited deep-rooted samskaras. So, Patanjali calls them raga, dvesha, abhinivesha. So, those of you who have the text with you, if you look at the third sutra of Sadhanapada, you can find this in the third sutra, the second chapter. Avidya asmita raga dvesha abhinivesha pancha kleshaha. Here, five kleshas are translated in English as afflictions. Affliction means, as I mentioned earlier, strong deep-rooted tendencies and impressions. Some of them very good, some of them very bad. So, avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, abhinivesha, kleshaha. So, klesha is nothing but first, we have a wrong notion about ourselves. Very often, our attitude, our interpretation of experiences depends upon how we interpret ourselves. How we look upon ourselves. So our interpretation, our definition of external things, or our reading of external experiences essentially depends upon our interpretation of ourselves. What are we according to ourselves? So, but there are many obstructions that come in the process. Many kinds of obstructions in the process. These obstructions are called antarayas in the Patanjali system. So those who have got the text, I shall quote that particular sutra. So those who have got the text, you can mention that. But just a minute. Yes, a very, very interesting description of the effect of these problems, the effect of these problems you find here. How we face these problems? Patanjali first of all explains how we must face these external conditions so that many of these kleshas can be avoided. For that he recommends four or five methods of reacting to external conditions. Maitri, Karuna, Mudita, Ubekshanam, Sukadukha Punya, Punya Vishayanam, Bhavanadaha, Chitta Prasadhanam. So, how to get out of the shackles of inherited samskaras, tendencies and impressions? Normally, when we react to a situation, we may perhaps become hostile, or we may become friendly, or we may become extremely attached, or we may become extremely negative. Any such mental action will produce a residual effect in the mental system, and that will remain in our chittam. So, first, he says, how to attain chitta prasada? This is the first step towards kaivalya, liberation. Chitta prasada means when your mind is friendly with itself. When the mind acts as a friend and not as a tormentor. That state of mind is called chitta prasada. So, first, when we meet people of our own temperament, let us say those are interested in spiritual life, those are interested in positive ideas, we must be friendly with them. Because if your friendship with people of your own tendency will help you to enrich your own positive tendencies. On the other hand, our friendship and association with people of opposite tendencies may perhaps disturb our mental system and may create problems. So, as far as possible, we must keep close contact with people of identical tendencies. This is not possible in this modern world. That's a fact. So, he recommends a method. He says, whenever we encounter an experience either coming from within our own mind or from outside, which is not good for us, which we understand to be harmful to us, we should not befriend it, but we should not hate it. If you antagonize, if you hate, if you have a negative attitude towards anything, that also brings you into contact with it. And if you establish friendship with a negative tendency within your own mind, or coming from outside, that also will strengthen this negative tendency. That means, so he says, we should be able to watch our own emotions. Suppose anger, hatred, or undesirable tendencies emerge in our own mind. When we become aware of this happening, when we observe this happening in our own mind, what happens is, it disappears. When you observe it, it disappears. When you are aware of the fact that you are getting angry without any reason, then you are no more angry. In fact, without an attempt to control it, you will not become aware of it. When you become aware of it, it disappears. So, he says, this is called a kind of indifference, looking upon our own mind as an object that we witness, that we see without identifying ourselves with it. Then what happens? Some negative samskaras will not get accumulated in the mental system. So that's why avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, abhinivesha. Raga, I already explained, extreme attachment towards things which we know very well to be harmful to us. See, drug addiction, many of these are classical examples. Extreme addiction to internet, extreme addiction to alcoholism, these are all the most gross examples of this sort of problem, raga. Dvesha, again, irrational aversion towards things. We know fully well that it has no reason. But when we observe our own mental attitudes, that means when we objectify, when we become a non-participating witness of our own emotions, then our emotions fall within our control. So when we watch our mind is controlled. Our emotions are restrained. When you observe them without being a part of it, either by liking or by or through aversion, if we don't link ourselves to that emotion, then the emotion becomes an object and we become the subject. Then it becomes completely controlled. Abhinivesha is also irrational fear. Moving away from certain things due to fear, moving towards certain things, and moving against certain things. The three tendencies that Patanjali outlines here. All because we have a wrong understanding of what we are. Avidya, or avidya means wrong notion about ourselves, is the root cause of all these things. So, through these processes, you reach a point of samadhi that we already explained in the third chapter. We completed that portion. When we attain this, then there are different ways of developing skills. And I shall begin the first sutra of the fourth chapter. The very interesting, very revealing. The sutra is Janma Ushadhi Mantra Tapa Samadhi Jaha Siddhayaka. So if those who have got the text with you, Siddhayaka Samadhi Jaha means Janma Ushadhi Mantra Tapa Samadhi Jaha. Siddhaya means skills, powers. The powers, tremendous mental, psychological powers that you develop can be inborn. You may be born with it. There are some people who are born with certain skills, and those powers can be created through medication, through aushadhi. I will come to that. It's interesting. Or mantra java, recitation of sacred words, or extreme mortification, extreme effort in that direction, or concentration. This is the sutra which you... So, if you read this translation, you may not get the full meaning. What it says, the great siddhis can be acquired by birth, by you may be born with it, chemical means, power of words, mortification, concentration. This is the first sutra. So it doesn't directly deal with Kaivalya, but it gives a warning actually. So those who try to develop special skills through some taking some mantra, so you can see examples, certain, I don't want to mention those things, certain drugs can improve, can give you power of concentration, but that is only a prelude to disaster. So these are all mentioned here. And extreme tapa, extreme mortification, extreme effort in one direction can also enable you to attain great things. But that also is not without risk. There are people who are born with certain great skills. Those skills may develop through constant practice, but also requires mutual enrichment. There are two methods employed, mentioned here, mantra and samadhi. Samadhi means concentration. First of all, one should be fully established in yamas and niyamas, which are the fundamental moral, ethical, spiritual disciplines that every spiritual person should develop. Non-violence, austerity, ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, abhigraha, freedom from greed, freedom from extreme desires, and in pure life, contentment, purity, inner and outer purity, all these disciplines together, 10 qualifications are mentioned. We already discussed this elaborately in many, at least in 10-15 classes we discussed this. I am not repeating here again. So when you get established in all these great spiritual and ethical disciplines and qualities, then if you practice austerity, it can take us through a positive path to higher spiritual goal. But again, that is why Patanjali refers, people try to develop special powers and skills by different means, by different methods. He is not recommending, he is giving an observation, he says. So anything that is artificially created can be a big problem, can be a liability, can be a great risk. So there are only two methods mentioned here which are approved by yoga philosophers. One is mantra. When you recite a sacred word with great concentration, when you approach that sacred word with a sense of sanctity and sacredness, the word has a spiritual content in it. When you meditate on the meaning of that particular mantra, then slowly the essence of that mantra will be your experience. You will reach the experience dimension of that mantra. First you may hear it loudly, then your chanting, your practice of the mantra becomes more and more subtle, and a time comes when you realize the essence of what that mantra implies. But here again, before undertaking this task, one should be fully established in yamas and niyamas. That means the 10 fundamental disciplines of its universal. More essential disciplines are 5: ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, aparigraha, non-violence, non-stealing, freedom from greed, freedom from possessing things, and also pure life, and contentment, inner and outer purity, feeding our mind with good food, good spiritual food. All these disciplines should be perfected. Then when we practice this sacred mantra, it will help us. Or meditation or samadhi mentioned here. So the first sutra directly is not dealing with the subject of liberation. It only makes a statement that great powers of mind are normally attained by people, or people try to attain great powers. Either maybe they are born with those powers, certain people with great skills of mind and intellect, or they may develop through artificial means, or like some medications. There are people, physical strength, psychological powers can be increased through certain methods, but those methods will be totally disastrous in the end, unless one is fully established in yamas and niyamas. Tapa means extreme concentration, focused, concentrated effort, and samadhi, that is higher meditation. These are the 5 means by which people try to acquire great skills. The subject we discussed here is a direct reference to the Vibhuti Pada, the second chapter, which deals with the powers and effects. Anyway, so in the course of time, it becomes clear to you. Thank you. Now we'll have interaction. That's the most exciting and challenging session. So you can ask any questions on this subject or any subject. Most welcome. Yeah.
Understandable to befriend oneself. However, I don't understand why, as a member of humanity, why would a person be thy own enemy?
Yeah.
And excuse me, and who or what, I know we speak about avidya,
yeah,
but there must be some other powers, yeah, or focuses that take possession,
yeah,
at the ruination of the individual.
Okay, now, you know, the humanity is one, physically and spiritually. Vedanta and yoga, they all believe there is one spiritual truth, the reality you may call God or Atman, present in everyone. So, at the spiritual level, humanity is one. And the material level also, every human body is practically identical in the fundamental general constitution. There is no difference. Where is the difference? The difference is only in the manifestation of that inherent goodness, divinity, whatever you call it. That differs. So, here, one word is used in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra. Upeksha is the used. Maitri, Karuna, Mudita, Upekshanam. Fourth discipline is indifference is the meaning. You can be friendly, you can be compassionate. You should appreciate good qualities in others. And there are certain things that you, certain people that you should be indifferent towards. That's the meaning. So what he means is, at the beginning of a spiritual life, if you allow your mind to be influenced by every person who comes in contact with you, or you may come in contact with, at the beginning of a spiritual life, there is every chance that your conviction may be shaken. You know, a plant, at the beginning, when it's a small plant, it may be eaten away by a goat or a cattle. So you need a fence around. When it becomes a tree, there's no problem. So, at the beginning of our spiritual life, even this is important even for bringing up children, really speaking. So it doesn't mean that you draw demarcation between people, not at all. What it means is, and the commentators make it clear, you should have an inner mental filtering mechanism. You should try to develop a kind of inner filtering mechanism that helps you to filter out the undesirable, the negative influences that may come to our mind, that may shake our convictions. So that's the explanation here. It doesn't mean that you should draw a line of demarcation once for all. At the beginning of our spiritual life, the unity of humanity is only a concept. But frequently we are not able to live up to your concept. Concepts and mind are two different things. We live at the level of our mental attitudes and emotions. They sometimes will agree with the concept, but not always. So what Patanjali says is, at the beginning of our spiritual life, we should not hate anyone, we should not antagonize anyone, but you should be able to understand that the whole humanity is not the same level of evolution. So, for example, a child who is working hard, a student working hard for the examinations, he may meet a friend may tell you, oh, there is no point in studying hard, working hard, don't worry. And he may, perhaps, his words could influence negatively, and the student may feel discouraged to work from working hard for examination, whatever it is. It's a kind of example of negative influence. You should not tell the student, you should not listen to the person, you should hate him, not at all. The point is, when such ideas come, we should have our mind ready to filter them out so that they do not affect us. Like this, like a plant that requires a fence around at the early stage of its growth. Patanjali deals with this problem. He says, a concept or an idea on the one hand and a matter of experience on the other are two different things. Very often there is a wide gap between an idea or a concept and its experience equivalent. So how to bridge the gap? Slowly we must make it our real attitude. An attitude that we assume will not be ours, may not work. Fundays above, well, the whole, see, you can't, we can't act like Christ and Buddha right now. But if we work hard one day, we may be able to act like that. Right now, we may pretend, but we won't be able to act, really. So we have to reach that stage, that's a goal to be attained, this idea behind.
We talk about the reverse evolution.
Yeah.
Is Prakriti an evolution of Purusha, or is it the other way around?
Yeah. When we reverse the evolutionary process from material to higher Prakriti, then we understand that our true nature is Purusha. Prakriti is only an imposition. The idea that we are all made of matter, that we are not essentially consciousness itself, that's a wrong idea. That will be reversed when we reverse the evolution from matter, from the Panchamahabhudas, all the way beyond Panchamahabhudas, we have to reach Tanmatra level. From Tanmatra, we have to reach the Mahatattva level. From Ahankara, Satya Ahankara, then Mahatattva, then Prakriti. So, what happens is, when we start redefining ourselves, in actual practice, when we try to reprioritize our own values, then we are actually reversing the evolutionary process. Even when we take interest in philosophy, mysticism, higher ideas, which we know will not in any way give us one extra dollar, or will not improve our material life by anything, when we do something that gives us a higher sense of identity, we are actually beginning to reverse the evolutionary process. As we get more and more engrossed into in material world, it is the natural evolution all the way from Prakriti to matter. From matter, when we make the flow move forward, onward, backward, you reach Prakriti. When you reach that, then you understand your true nature is Purusha, consciousness, not Prakriti. That is called reverse evolution. Well, when I read these technical words, when I use these technical words, you may think it's a very some kind of an occult process, but really it is not so. In real life, we all have our own priorities, our own values, our own preferences. Our preferences, our priorities, in a way reveal where we stand in real life. There is no doubt about it. What we like, what we consider to be the most essential thing in our life, that reveals where we stand in the evolutionary scale. So once we can ascend this process of evolution, this evolutionary flow, go to a higher levels, then this is called reverse evolution. It's called involution The word involution was used by George Santayana, because it was first used in modern times by Vivekananda. He was the one who used the word. When dealing with Sankhya philosophy, he used the word involution. It means we can move backward, which actually a kind of moving forward, really. From matter to subtle elements, then to cosmic intelligence, then Prakriti, then to the realization that we are Purusha, we are awareness. That is actually ascending, a kind of ascent. You wanted to?
You mentioned some of the influence of Indian philosophy on Greek philosophy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I would say. Thales, Heraclitus, and of course, much later after them, Democritus, then Neoplatonists like Porphyry, Philo, all these are examples where, for example, the belief in reincarnation and a subtle idea of law of karma are examples. Thales believed in four fundamental chaturmahabhudas actually. He left out space. Thales lived in the 7th century BC. So Heraclitus believed, for example, in the fundamental unity of existence, creation. And Plato's concept of the great being is another example. So you find in different systems of philosophy, a kind of moving towards the idea of some kind of a cosmic one reality which is both all-pervading and also immanent, present in everyone, everything, and also all-pervading. So omnipresence through immanence. It becomes omnipresent through immanence. So that idea, you may find, I think the whole trend of thought was perhaps it got a great blow with the emergence of Augustine, you know, who knew Greek thought, but then he discerned the Neoplatonist influences or the ancient Greek mystery religions, you know. So everything was replaced by the very arbitrary conceptual interpretation of the theology, like the radical sinfulness of man and ideas like that, which where speculation has no place. So belief replaced free intellectual inquiry, which is the essence of Plato's approach in philosophy. So in a way, it was a death blow to Greek thought. It happened in 5th century AD with the emergence of Augustine. So Augustine tried, he inherited Greek philosophical heritage, tried to retain it, but then in the process, in his interpretation of biblical theology on the basis of the radical sinfulness of man and the inherited sinfulness, which certainly ran contrary to the trend of free inquiry which characterized Plato's approach. Don't you agree? The glory of Sankhya system is he doesn't speak about a God. I don't say it itself is a great thing. What I mean to say, without the help of an invisible transcendental moral authority, this Kapila, Ishvara Krishna, who later actually expounded the Sankhya system, he's expounding this inquiry. God is not ruled out, remember. It's not an atheistic system in that sense, but it's a very, very, very rational approach. Okay.
We experience consciousness when we are awake, sleeping, and in deep sleep. How do we know that the same consciousness exists after we die?
Yeah, okay. Well, instead of consciousness, you may replace the word with Atman. Okay, now, you know, you remember dreams when you wake up, you know. So there should be somebody who is present both in dream state and also in waking state. Then only you will be able to remember dream experiences, even after waking up. So, unless the same person, same entity is present in both the states of experiences, memory is not possible. Memory is nothing but a connecting bridge between the two states, actually. It's a connecting bridge. So, in deep sleep also, that awareness, the Atman is present, but you are not aware of it. You are not aware of your own experiences. So in dreamless deep sleep, the plurality is present. The plurality is not experienced. That means you don't transcend plurality. You are not aware of it because your instrument, namely the mind, with which you experience plurality in dreams, is benumbed. So Vedantis call it mind merges with Mula Vidya. So it's clear to you? Okay? Okay, right. So I think we have taken a lot of time. So this is the first class. We'll continue. Om Shanti, 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat, Sri Ramakrishna Panamastu.